nothing about your crazy ways. Don't say you're sorry, 'cause we both know it don't.
You know, when you have a voice like that and you're Betty Levette, you can just have an album called Levette. That's great. Betty Levette's new album is Levette. And that is the music we are playing this morning. We welcome you and your questions always on the show. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. And we'll get to those when the time comes. I do want to remind you, though, to keep your letters short and to the point, and that way we can get to as many as possible. We have a lot to talk about today. Now, let me get to our wonderful panel and introduce everybody. Aaron Pisidius here, Siena College professor of economics.
I say economics, but economics. I've never, you know, if you read like Aristotle and the Greeks, they have like the OE combined. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
So do you know how that's pronounced?
Economics.
Economics. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We got to the bottom of that. All right, that's good.
Yeah, but you know
my Greek alphabet.
But it's like home ec, you know. It's just like you think yeah. Yeah. Well, regardless, that's what you do. And
everybody, yep, we all know what that means.
And you're here, and we thank you very much. It's good,
good morning.
Good to see you. We're also, Heather Mulligan will be with us. She'll be here in about 15 minutes, president and CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Heather Mulligan will be here. And I couldn't be more happy to have our next panelist. She is one of our dear, dear friends here and just a magnificent person and a magnificent powerhouse in the artistic community in the region and in the Berkshires. And we love when she comes and visits us. She's the artistic director and CEO of the Berkshire Theater Group. Kate McGuire, good morning. How are you?
Thank you. I was so glad to see you, Aaron, because I thought, oh, we're going to be talking about the Fed and the rates and all of that. And
we'll throw inflation in for good measure, too.
Good thing Aaron is here.
Well, yeah, Aaron wrote yesterday and said, Can I talk about inflation? I'm like, go to it, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Knock yourself out. That is our group this morning. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. I just want to remind, or maybe you don't even know this yet. I'll tell you, if you don't know, I'll tell you that Kate not only is going to be on the panel, but we'll get to all the good stuff that's coming up at Berkshire Theater Group and the amazing summer season that you have underway.
It started.
It has started, and it is underway, and it is great, and Kate will be with us at 11 o'clock to give us a full preview. So we'll tease that for the moment and remind folks to stay tuned to that. All right, let's go to what we want to talk about today, and there is I think there's a fair amount to talk about today, but we'll... Now I just have to. Now I just have to find it. Ah, that is okay. Got it. You know what, Aaron? Let's start with you because I think this is interesting about the Fed rates. This we didn't know what was going to happen, and maybe you did.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sorry.
Sorry.
That's why he's here.
I did not mean for that to come out the way it did. I apologize.
Yes, idiot. I did know what was going to happen. No. Fed leaves rates steady but forecasts more moves. Central bankers have raised rates at the fastest pace since the 1980s, but now they're taking time to survey how the changes are working. And I guess the part of the story that I found somewhat surprising is I guess I didn't expect rates to go anywhere this time. However, I did that idea of this is always going to be somewhat precarious was the element that I think I didn't expect.
Yeah. So, for the first time since March of 2022, the Fed has stopped, paused their rate increases. It's been 10 straight rate increases from 0% all the way up to 5%. And they've been doing that to intentionally slow the economy down. We've had inflation that's resulted from COVID supply chain bottlenecks. We've had inflation that's resulted from Putin's invasion of Ukraine. So there has it's been a very anomalous 3 years. And the big problem that resulted from that was rising inflation. So the Fed's trying to cool down the economy and get inflation under control. And what a lot of economists have been saying, and it's why I made that snarky comment of like, well, I did at the beginning, is that many economists thought that the Fed was being overly aggressive in how they were dealing with inflation, is that they're going to create a lot of unnecessary unemployment. They're going to create a lot of unnecessary layoffs. They're going to create a lot of unnecessary contraction in the economy because they're, you know, being too aggressive with inflation. So we saw that with the banking crisis that unfolded in March and remained contained, largely due to the intervention from the FDIC and the Fed. But this, you know, the Fed's decision to pause rate increases, but they also telegraphed, we're going to raise interest rates by another half a percentage point over the next year. That came on the heels of Tuesday's inflation report, which was surprisingly low. So inflation, the cost of living, the average, you know, increase in the prices of the goods and services we buy, peaked at 9% last summer, and now it's down to 4%. So the Fed has seen a meaningful decrease in inflation, and I think that's giving them some cause to say, let's see what the last 10 rate increases have done, because there's always a lag. When the Fed raises interest rates, it can take 6 to 12 months before that's felt in commercial lending markets and consumer lending markets. So the Fed's, you know, there's all of this backlog of rate increases, and it's going to hit very likely like a tidal wave at some point. So the Fed wants to make sure they're not overshooting. But the inflation report was really good. It's really a story of rising food prices and shelter prices. So, you know, food prices are up because of Putin's invasion of Ukraine and how that interrupted the international flow of grain that's used. Also, and I, you know, thank Judith Enk for always pointing this out, you know, this low-grade effect of climate change, which is turning from low-grade to medium-grade, the droughts, the extreme weather creates a lot of uncertainty and shortages in food production domestically and internationally. So in my opinion, the Fed's overshooting. They've gone too far, and they really need to just stop and wait to see how things play out, because if they don't and they continue with their planned rate increases, it's going to cause a lot of unnecessary layoffs, a lot of slowing growth. It's going to raise the cost of borrowing money to buy a home, borrowing money to buy a car, borrowing money to do anything. Those costs go up. So, you know, the Fed's trying to, you know, depress wages, depress growth, and they're trying to kind of restore the normal order where, wage growth is low, so workers don't have a lot of bargaining power, and that, you know, shifted back to an era where businesses have, you know, far more power over, you know, the economy and their workers. So, you know, they're overshooting. They should consider that pause to go on for an extended period of time instead of transmitting the fact that they're going to raise rates more.
When do you see problems starting to arise?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I would think that, you know, based on when the Fed started, how aggressive they've been, you're probably going to see the negative effects of that. Increased unemployment, rising layoffs, less borrowing in late 23, early 24. So probably not for a while, right. But it will happen, and it probably will be more severe than a lot of economists are expecting.
As an administrator and artistic director, but in the arts, it's been my understanding that sort of Main Street and the arts sort of feel the impact first of
every time something happens in the economy, whether it's, you know, everyone is talking about inflation or the stock market is shifting, giving slows way down.
Yeah.
We're not seeing, our houses have been really full, so we're seeing good ticket sales, but contributions are always impacted just because people get scared about what's mm-hmm. to come. And your chaos, the arts, artists kind of thrive in chaos, but the arts themselves, the organizations, don't. It's an interesting.
That's really interesting. So meaning that the artists, the idea of the arts, it can.
Well, we stand in the middle of chaos all the time in the arts, right?
Right.
And it is the artist that observes around them what's going on.
The chaos is their muse.
For some. And what we're always doing on a stage, whether it's music or dance or whatever, is trying to show what it means to be human. So if there's a lot going on, there's a lot of energy out there, and there's a lot driving the artist.
And then can you say to the audience, you see that? That's what we're trying to avoid. Can you give us money?
Well, of course we say that. I say it all, just like you do.
Like every night,
I
right?
say it yeah. all the time.
Yeah.
And it is that we are also, our organization is a not-for-profit. I truly mean a not-for-profit.
Right.
Which is an interesting or kind of organization to be in a capitalist society.
How has and one more thing that I'm fascinated by, because it also and this is with the colonial, I guess you see this at Stockbridge too, but with the colonial right in Pittsfield, mm-hmm. The city feels it too, right?
Of course, the city feels it. I mean, Stockbridge at this particular time, I think, continues to thrive. There are a lot of second homeowners in Stockbridge. So it's a very different community than Pittsfield. We feel really fortunate, though, Joe. Our numbers, people are coming out again. And maybe it's because they were locked up during COVID, but people are coming to the theater. People are coming to the Colonial. My goodness, how many were there when you were there for David Sedaris?
Yeah.
Over 700 people.
Yeah.
And the night before we had a comedian, it was the same number. So our numbers in terms of people in the seats, we're doing well. It's just, it really is the contributed side. And foundations start to go down. Mm-hmm. And so at a time of chaos, when people need the arts more than ever, we struggle harder. But like everyone else, I think, right?
Sure. Yeah, no. It's just an interesting perspective, because that's not something that, you know, we normally talk about when we're talking about the Fed. There's, you know, talk about the banking sector, but never the art sector.
Yeah. And it is nice. Also true that we have never been treated so well by the government as we were over the past 3 years.
Meaning the help that they gave you during COVID.
Yes. They sustained the arts in this country.
So, and then what was it like to lose that then?
It's not good.
So you're doing well, and then it stops.
The faucet shut off.
Yeah. And you know it's going to shut off. But,
we do know it's going to shut off.
But you're still, it's hard to fully wrap it.
That's one of the reasons that we keep saying the faucet is going to shut off. We hope that you'll remember that your ticket takes care of 50% of what we do. And the other 50%, we need your donations.
Beg, borrow, and steal. Well, not steal.
I was going to say, I think beg and borrow.
Yeah, I didn't.
Beg, borrow.
Yeah.
We don't steal. We'd get caught before anyone.
Hi. Hello. Good
morning. Heather Mulligan is here, president and CEO of the Business Council of New York State. How are you?
Good. I experienced a very concentrated gravitational anomaly this morning at my home, making it very hard to get out of bed.
Oh.
It only, you know, it happens once in a while, and it usually coincides with a black tie event the evening before.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh, the
Yeah.
You chambered in it, right?
Yeah, last night.
Oh, my.
Just had a hard time getting up this morning, so I'm sorry, but I'm always late anyway.
Is that a gravitational issue? Or is that
it's gravitational. That, okay. Yeah. It's too small to be detected by, you know, anyone
sure.
who monitors
Sanders
it. But I can tell you it's
I thought you had a dog on your chest or something.
I know. No, it's an actual gravitational surge that occurs right in, you know, in my house.
Amazing.
Well, yeah.
I've never used that explanation. That's
good. I've used many others. I started running out of excuses. So I live in a different time zone thing.
Sure,
approximately a half hour behind
everything else.
Well, we're glad you're here, and we're going to continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A wonderful group this morning assembled: Kate McGuire, Heather Mulligan, and Aaron Pacitti. We, again, welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Keep them short and to the point, and we'll get to as many as possible. We'll be back right after news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, listening to Betty Levette's new album, Levette. And you can see the complete playlist at wamc.org/roundtable. Kate McGuire, Aaron Pacitti, and Heather Mulligan with us this morning. Heather, anything you would like to say about the Fed rates and the general state of the economy?
I feel as though it's always wise to agree with Aaron. As I think last time I disagreed with him on something and I said, I'm no economist, and some listener immediately called me out and said, I should not speak to things upon which I am not an expert.
But, you know, I got so many positive comments about our back and forth. I think we were talking about the minimum wage.
Yeah,
land to me.
Yeah, no. I think you're right. Actually, bring it on. I actually do agree with you. I think that it's a lagging indicator, and I think that, you know, the impact of the rate increases we're going to feel at some point. We're not getting the full effect of them. I think that this is a weird environment, though, because the labor participation rate is so low right now that even with layoffs, and we saw in the tech sector, there's not a huge impact on unemployment. So some of the indicators that they've reached their limit might not actually be coming into effect.
Right.
And I mean, my employers will tell you, like, we are in a very big workforce problem. Mm-hmm. I had a debate a number of years ago with someone who's now a member of Congress when he was in the assembly, who he was really worried about what was going to happen with automation. And, you know, we didn't talk specifically about AI, but basically technology replacing people in terms of workforce. And my comment back to him was, we have a demographic issue. We're not going to be able to maintain GDP with the population that we have. And now it's even worse because of what happened with immigration during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people left the workforce and didn't come back. There's still about 1.5 million people missing from the workforce. Mm-hmm. So if we want to keep our GDP robust, and New York actually has very high GDP per capita, mainly because of the financial services industry, we need people in the workforce, and we need to automate, and we need AI. We need all of those things. I am concerned that the other impacts of inflation, of rate increases, are going to really be damaging, especially in borrowing and lending. Lending, I guess, is
I've been debating whether or not to say this because it's kind of technical and nerdy, but it's really important. Is that the way the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates the inflation rate? 40% of that is housing costs, but the way they measure housing costs looks at leases that were signed over the past year. So when they released the inflation report on Tuesday, that was looking at rent increases that happened in the summer of 2022. Mm. Now, that was the peak of the housing price increase. That was the peak of the rental increase. If you look at more current data on that produced by Zillow and, you know, other, you know, realtor sites, those are now negative. Like, rents have come down since then substantially and are actually decreasing in price. So real inflation is probably closer to 2%+ instead of 4%, because what the Bureau of Labor Statistics measure is picking up is the rapid appreciation in housing and rent prices last summer. So they've already come down, but right. that's not being included in it. So I that's why I said that I really think the Fed is overshooting, and they would be wise to just say, you know, we're just going to not hit the gas nor tap the brakes for an extended period of time until we see this play out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had a meeting last week in Buffalo and met with a real estate developer who was expressing his frustration at the fact that, you know, he has built a number of residential developments as part of whatever local incentive package. And, you know, and this is just this is how it works. A number of the units that he builds are low income, mm-hmm. Affordable housing units. Well, he wants to expand. He wants to build more affordable housing, and he can't get a loan because during the pandemic he couldn't evict anyone.
Sure,
a lot of people didn't pay their rent. He has no ability to recover that. So on the books, the math doesn't work, and the interest rates are higher. So the banks are saying, "Hey, you know, this is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. We're not going to lend you money to build more affordable housing because you're not generating enough income off of what you've got already, you know, to service the debt." Well, this is a problem, right? And at the same time, we have our legislature talking about further restricting the ability to basically remove tenants who are not paying the rent. So that's going to compound the problem as we head down the road, especially if the interest rates for borrowing are as high as they are, because you need more money to pay mm-hmm. them back.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's a huge problem in Berkshire County, too.
Yep.
I mean, nobody can find enough labor. And housing, when we hire people to come, and a lot of times we'll get college grads that are just starting their first job, and so they're moving to the Berkshires, and they can't find anything affordable. And it's exactly what you were just saying, Heather. The contractors and the developers in the area can't make the numbers work, and it just
right.
it just keeps spiraling.
Yeah, and the more we tilt the table away from allowing the people to recoup their investment in the property, the fewer units get built. So it sure. actually, policies that are intended
compounds
to protect people compounds the problem and makes real estate more expensive. I mean, New York City is a very sort of distinct example of
sure.
that, and there's a lot of other problems there. I mean, I think people forget sometimes, like with Manhattan, it is an island, and island real estate is always more expensive because you don't have the room you have to build up, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which is more expensive. But It's. I think we're going to be talking a lot more about housing costs. And I also think there was another cost pressure on the cost of building new housing because of supply chain issues during the pandemic.
Sure.
And that's, you know, slowly recovering. But, you know, just the cost all the way around went up. And
this is going to take years to work out of the system.
Yep.
And I think the Fed's trying to squeeze it all out in, you know, 12 months. And I think some of this will get worked out naturally.
Yeah.
Some of it will be a lingering issue. And I think the Fed's trying to accelerate that. But I think the bigger risk is that they're going to overshoot and create a lot of unnecessary unemployment and, in you know, the worst case scenario, a recession.
Let's go to some letters from our listeners. Valerie writes, when and how, Aaron, did 2% become the magic number for an agreeable inflation rate?
Well, economists are still wondering that. It was, I don't know specifically when, but it was, I believe, in the 2000s, right around Ben Bernanke's chairship. 2%, you know, there's no magic. 2% is not a magic number. Why isn't it 3%? Why isn't it 4%? Why isn't it 1%? And the reason is that it's 2% because you need a little bit. The Fed needs a little bit of wiggle room. If you shoot for 0% inflation and you overshoot, then you create long periods of exceptionally slow growth. If you let inflation run above 0% at like 2% and overshoot, the damage is minimized. But a lot of economists are calling for inflation, an inflation target of like 3 or 4% because it can allow for faster wage growth, it allows for increased economic activity, and it moves the Fed out of a corner. Right, where they don't feel the need to just, you know, be hawkish all the time like they're doing now. So it's arbitrary. There's nothing magic about 2%. That's just where the Fed landed about 20 years ago.
But they can't change it while they're taking corrective action, right? I mean, I think it would undermine the credibility.
So Jerome Powell, you're right. In 2020, he announced that the 2% is not a ceiling, it's an average. So if you run below the 2% average for a period of time, then you should compensate by running above the 2% average. So over a decade, it averages out.
Right.
But in this environment, no, the Fed can't change course and be like, oh, by the way, we're going to go for
3%. We decided 4% was
right. Yeah, no, that's better. That's a better decision to make during calmer, less turbulent times.
Right, yeah.
Joe writes to us and says, in our personal experience, giving has had less of an effect on our taxes over the last couple years. My understanding is that the Trump tax cuts made it so that for middle class families, middle income families like ours, charitable giving now has to hit a higher level in order to count towards our deduction. We don't give just to get, but the tax break did allow us to give more in years past. I wonder if others have had the experience and what impact on the nonprofit arts sector has been. My thanks to all in the arts and nonprofit media world. Your work makes us better as a country and a culture.
Yes, another impact that, you know, we receive negatively, for sure, that people aren't getting the same benefit at a certain level of income. You can't take that benefit. And in addition to that, for the artists themselves who used to be able to take tax breaks for classes and, you know, their hair appointments because they had to go to a certain function or they had to go to an audition, whatever it was, books, movies that they have to do for the sake of their craft, all of those deductions are gone. So that affects, you know, those changes that Mr. Trump made really impacted us.
Tom writes, don't forget to add corporate bloat to the causes of inflation.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's, thank you, Tom. There's been a lot of...
Aaron, rule of thumb, never pass up the chance to say corporate bloat.
Yeah, no, I know. It's, how about this one? So the Biden administration has been talking about a lot of sludge in the system, which is... these fees that just come out of nowhere when you buy a good, like concert tickets is the obvious example, right? You buy, you go to the Ticketmaster website to go see Noel Gallagher at SPAC and it's, oh, $40. And then you get to the final page and it's like, oh no, it's $75 because there's $35 of service fees and handling fees. So that's...
I've heard those described as hidden fees. I've heard them described as garbage fees.
Who's opening for Noel Gallagher, incidentally? Garbage.
Garbage. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, I just want to say, if we're going to go down this road, then government shouldn't be allowed to do it either. I mean, on your utility bill, more than half of that are taxes and fees that have nothing to do with the service that's being provided. And they're not allowed to tell you because that's what the rules are. The rules say they're not allowed to say, well, this is the 18A surcharge that's being used to fund the regulator. This is the blah, blah, blah. And same with health insurance.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, this is the point.
You know, it's all a bunch of crap. But if government is going to say you private sector can't add a handling fee and can't, well, they shouldn't be able to do it either.
But it's not the government that's adding the fee.
No, it is.
No, it's National Grid.
Well, no, it's not, and that's where you misunderstand. It's not National Grid that's adding the fee. It is the government. They are mandated to collect money that they then hold. It's a regulatory asset that they then hold and they turn over to the government that gets used to fund other things, not them.
Okay.
It's the same. And the same is true in health insurance.
Okay. So help me out here. So this is, we have to take, well, all right, we'll take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about these fees and so forth. And then we'll get back to letters and then the show will be over. We'll take a
talk about boxes.
Someone
talk about boxes.
Boxes? Yeah. In the bathroom.
We'll take a break and be right back after. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Kate McGuire, Aaron Pasitti, and Heather Mulligan with us this morning. So we were talking about, we've been talking about inflation. We've been talking about Fed rates. And we also started talking about the latest from Live Nation. The story came out yesterday, not just Live Nation, but live events and ticket companies are taking steps to no longer surprise customers with fees at checkout and instead include those fees up front in the total price. The White House, Live Nation, and SeatGeek announced the voluntary moves Thursday. President Biden met later in the afternoon with officials from those companies, as well as representatives from ticketing companies that had been using transparent or all-in pricing for years. Adding fees toward the end of a purchase can be deceptive and harmful to consumers, experts say. In his State of the Union address in February, President Biden called them out as junk fees. Sitting with officials from SeatGeek, Live Nation, and other companies, Biden again took aim at the practice, describing the fees as hidden charges that companies sneak into your bill to make you pay more without you really knowing it initially. So, just so I have this right, help me out, friends. The prices aren't going to change here, right?
Right.
The end
right.
result, if you said the price of the ticket is $250 and you end up spending $375, now it's just going to be $375.
Right.
Probably.
Yes.
Well, that's stupid.
Well, that's because they have. That's because these firms have monopoly power in the industry. There's no competition because Ticketmaster and Live Nation just have a chokehold on.
Well,
live
and they
music.
Know that
so, yeah, they can get
someone's
going
to pay $375 for a ticket for whoever, for garbage or whoever you were talking about.
I'm never going to admit.
Certainly for Taylor Swift, how much money are they going to get per ticket?
Well,
I mean, they're
going to
just
thousands.
Keep pushing it, right?
Well, the other thing I don't understand, too, is that Ticketmaster, and what interested me, too, about this is the practices that this didn't address, which one of the practices that Ticketmaster goes into is that flex pricing, where mm-hmm. suddenly there is no, much like the airlines, there is no ticket, face value ticket price for mm-hmm. for an event. And if you're on with 27,000 of your closest friends trying to get concert tickets, it'll go up as far as demand goes. So as demand increases, the price increases, and one person sitting in row L could have paid $125 and another person could have paid $285.
Yeah, I mean, I worked for a venue. I was a lobbyist, so I was contracted to work on the ticket scalping legislation in New York some years ago. And one of my clients actually said, we would like the ability to have our own reseller platform, and we will cap the price. But one of the reasons for it is they had huge swaths of season ticket holders who all they did was resell right. tickets at a huge profit. And they said, we want to be able to take those season tickets back, and we want to cap the price because they felt it was important that reputationally that their tickets be affordable to people in the community. And our state legislature said no. They said no, we think that you should not be able to take season ticket holder tickets away, therefore we're going to open up the market. And so you end up with this situation where someone's willing to pay $1,500, to go sit in a particular seat, the person making the profit is not the venue. The person making the profit is the reseller.
Can I just counter with that, though, that my understanding, too, a part of the problem on the in what you just described was that, because it sounds like a good idea, mm-hmm. and it sounds like instead of it going to the big bad ticket scalpers, it would instead be the venue, or it would be the
a hotel. You can't resell your hotel room at a profit just because it's Mardi Gras.
What happened is that then you go on and all of the quote unquote regular tickets are sold out, and the only thing left are the quote unquote premium tickets, which are three times the price as the other ones.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely more expensive seats than others. I mean, the other issue that may change moving forward was that there was no way to verify that the ticket was real if you were mm-hmm. not the actual mm-hmm. vendor, right? So they could know who the ticket was being transferred to. and also with that person, you know, decided to run naked through, you know, the stadium or, mm-hmm. you know, do something stupid in this, they could then prohibit them from coming back and say, no, you can't resell your ticket to this person because every time they show up, they, you know, they do some kind of a prank. They can't do that if it goes through. If a person is able to use a third party to resell the ticket. And so the only way that a person would know the ticket that they were getting was fake, and the venue wouldn't know the identity of the person who actually held the ticket. And then the only person, the only way that person would find out was fake is when they get to the door, right? So so then you've got the venue dealing with someone who's angry that they've been sold a fake ticket, and the person angry, and they're who are they going to get mad at? They get mad at the venue. Right. So it was causing a lot of conflict. That problem is unsolved. But with electronic tickets, I think it may be a little bit better. I mean, there was a lot more. I mean, I'm old. So when I worked on this, there was a lot more paper tickets were more the norm. Right. But there, you know, there's a lot of good reasons to maintain the information to go with the ticket. So, you know, who the person is, you can validate that it's an actual ticket, and you can also control the pricing. The venues, some of these venues, they don't want these tickets to be sold for these massive prices. Mm-hmm. They don't make the money. The reseller makes it.
No, I mean, the biggest issue here, and this goes back to the broader issue of inflation and what the letter writer brought up, is that you have this corporate bloat, which economists call increased market power, where, you know, most industries are dominated by two or three really big firms that control the pricing, and there's very little competition. So in the ticket market, you have Ticketmaster and Live Nation, right?
Which that's one and the same.
One, yeah, right. Now it's what is it called? Live Nation Entertainment or whatever. Yeah. But you know, for any major tour, Ticketmaster is going to handle the ticket sales, and Live Nation will handle the promotion of the show and everything. You know, you really have to go into the indie music market to deal with somebody outside of the Ticketmaster orbit.
But what Kate said I thought was fascinating a few moments ago, but people were willing to pay that.
Well, you know, for us, it's what will the market bear in the Berkshires for us, that, you know, for the theaters or for the Tanglewood or wherever. But we have those costs that are added on for postage. I mean, it's what makes up, you know, if we have to mail out tickets or for the systems that we use now. So I think it's $5 a ticket or something like that. If you're a member, then it gets waived. We are able to track, though, who the ticket holder is because our system goes
right to. So if you run naked through Honeol.
We take pictures.
Yeah, you know. Okay, all
right. We take pictures. So we can track, but there's not so many layers. I mean, as you're talking, I'm just thinking how complicated that all is. And we always have these internal arguments because we want to make sure that the community can get into the theater. And so how do we price those tickets to make sure everyone can walk in the doors?
I miss paper tickets.
Well, and some of the large venues do, especially for like sporting, they hold back groups of tickets that they then distribute to community groups, just so that there are people from the community who have access. And I'm not suggesting you should do that in theater. But,
oh, we do that.
Okay.
Though.
So
absolutely.
I think that's something that people don't recognize, that when you're talking about, you know, certain kinds of events and the resale price is so high, it is not the fault of the venue necessarily, you know, and in fact, some of these venues go out of their way to try and make sure that there's affordable seats available, you know, for people. Now, they're not the premium seats. There's no doubt about that.
Well, you know, for us, when we're working with Berkshire Bank or Greylock or any one of the sponsors that we have, part of what we're talking to them about is, yes, we appreciate your generosity, but you make sure, and we will make sure, that community groups are in, that kids are actually in the theater, and they are sitting in the front rows.
Right, okay.
Because we're also trying to develop that next generation all the time.
Yep.
So
let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back. First news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 16th of June. And because we will not be here on the 17th of June, I would like to wish my wife a happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Kelly's birthday tomorrow.
Yay.
Yeah, she hates when I do this. Oh, God, she hates it. And yet I still feel compelled to do it. I don't know why. But I feel like people should know it's her birthday because she won't tell anybody otherwise. Yeah. They should know, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Absolutely.
Happy birthday.
Well, we'll celebrate. All right.
$200 glasses of whiskey.
Woo! My goodness.
No. No, we're going to go see Tool instead. Okay. Let's see. We have letters on the subject. We've been talking about inflation and ticket prices and all kinds of stuff. Forrest writes, I'm wondering what you think about a windfall tax on corporations, seeing that the bulk of inflation was caused by profit seeking.
Well, the Biden administration did float the excess profit tax idea as a way to shift the burden of lowering inflation from workers to corporations. And I mean, we all know politically that's a non-starter, but that is something to consider because when you looked at oil company and fossil fuel profits following the invasion of Ukraine, they just went through the roof. Right. So one way to suck money out of the system instead of forcing workers out of a job is to just tax corporations on profits that exceed some historical norm.
It seems from the tone of this letter that Mark has told us this before, but bear with me.
Okay.
Mark says, again, inflation is not caused only by excessive demand. The supply curve should move up with the increased labor productivity we have witnessed in recent decades, but monopoly markets and value pricing allows producers to generate profits above the price of money rent. This is where inflation should be attacked.
So again, productivity growth has slowed over the past 20 years, not gone up, despite a lot of the technological innovations. Inflation can come from a variety of sources. It can come from increased pricing power of firms that are just able to raise prices without any type of competition that doesn't reflect increases in productivity. So we see that. So that's the supply side. It can come from shocks to the system like Putin invading Ukraine or COVID that just totally upend the normal flow of goods and services that create price pressures in unexpected places. And it can come from demand as well, right? So what the Fed is trying to do is decrease demand. They're trying to decrease purchasing power. They're trying to decrease economic activity. And that burden falls largely on, the middle class and workers who lose their job because lower wage, less educated workers are the first to go when interest rates go up. So talking about shifting that burden to corporations and shareholders as a way, I think, is a far more equitable solution than what we currently have.
There are some anomalies that we're dealing with, like the missing labor force. And actually, the lowest quartile, I think, of the income earners experienced the highest growth in wages rather than the top quartile, which is unusual.
Correct.
So we've got some anomalies here that we're dealing with. And I personally think a lot of it is related to the workforce shortages. And again, there's many factors there.
It's worth pointing out, though, I meant to piggyback on something you said before the break. That demographic problem the U.S. faces, that's a long-term trend. Like, baby boomers are retiring and fertility rates are way below replacement rates. So we are going to have chronic labor shortages for decades. It's not just a COVID problem. That's going to lead to higher inflation because firms are going to have to bid up wages.
Yep.
We're going to have higher food prices because of climate change, because, droughts and floods can seriously affect harvests. I think the era of low inflation that we had from the 90s up until 2019, 2020, I think that's a thing of the past. I think people need to prepare to live in a higher inflationary environment. And it's important that policymakers figure out a way to deal with that, whether it's the source problems like more flexible immigration policies or figuring out ways to better use technology, alleviating the effects of climate change, subsidies, corporate taxes. I think the future we're facing is going to be a little harsher than the past 20 or 30 years.
You're depressing me.
Wow. That's what I like.
Listen,
let's talk
Friday
about
morning.
Boxes.
A couple letters here from Jeremy comes. Corporate profits are currently through the roof, along with near record disparity between rich and poor. How do these issues affect inflation?
You know, so boy, this is why people hate economists. So on one hand, it can lower inflation because it strips.
Why do people hate economists?
Let me count the ways.
Okay, all
right. Because they're always right.
Well, there you go. So, just the statement alone.
Right, exactly. The conceited attitude. Inequality strips purchasing power from, you know, low and middle income groups. So that acts as a to depress inflation. Increased incomes for, you know, the richest 1%. That creates inflation, but not necessarily economy-wide inflation, because it's not like the richest – it's not like billionaires buy 100 times more food than
Cheetos,
the average –
Right.
Like, well, we have 40 blenders in this house.
Yeah,
like,
right.
the effects of their consumption on inflation are largely concentrated on goods that the average consumer doesn't buy. So inequality probably on net reduces inflation. I'm not saying that's a good solution to an inflationary problem.
I'm just going to say, like, for publicly traded companies, high corporate earnings benefit shareholders. So, and anyone who's got a 401k, especially if they're in index funds or anything like that, is benefiting. And that is vast swaths of the middle class who hold 401ks and are relying on those for their future. So, you know, corporate profits, everyone, and I cringe every time, corporate profits are not necessarily a bad thing for the economy. They are good for people who are, you know, invested in public markets. And now,
it's worth pointing out that the richest 10% own 90% of all stocks. So you're the bottom 90% of the population. So that broad swath owns a tenth of all of the wealth in the stock market.
You know, of all stocks, I mean, the other 10%, let's say, still represents a huge amount of, of 401ks and people. I mean, unless you're not in the market at all.
50% of the population is not in the market,
right, okay.
And that includes retirement
people,
funds.
But people who are invested in stocks, including retirees, including people who, you know, work at a corporation or a non-corporation that participate in their 401k, they're all reaping the benefits. It's not just the corporations, and it's not just the wealthy. The other thing I would just want to point out is I really hate the word corporation as a negative thing. It is a form of business. It is like a car calling, saying, well, look, sedans are bad, meaning all cars are bad, I mean, nonprofits are corporations. That's what they are. So using corporation as a sort of a negative thing, it just makes me cringe. I get it. It's easy for people to do, but it's just a form of business. That's it.
Right. I think what I frequently hear, especially from, the GE employees in Pittsfield that are retired and GE's long gone, and they remember the days when the profits were given right back to the employees. So there was a sense of things turning around.
There's a lot of companies that still do profit sharing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of companies that offer, shares and options as part of compensation packages, especially sort of in the tech space and startup firms. And, so that's an individual one company versus another company. It's not, to say if one company stopped doing this, then all companies are bad is not really fair.
Yeah. And I also before spoke about those corporations that are giving, that have foundation arms or marketing arms that are giving to community organizations or to not-for-profits.
I don't like the divisive nature of painting with such a broad brush and saying, well, all corporations are bad. I'm like, small nonprofits are corporations too. And we like them, right? So, and we like corporations that give shares to their employees, and we like corporations that give dividends to their shareholders, and we like corporations that donate to the community, and lots of them do. So to just use it as a negative connotation to me is just divisive.
Sure.
And I get it. This audience is not going to be the audience that is going to embrace this, right? But We live in a world where there's too much like everyone wants to hate on someone else. You know, could we please just recognize that, you know, not everyone who is every business that is a corporation is bad. I have to advocate for business and I like it. And I like what my members do and they support lots of people in the community.
So let us talk for a moment about the member. So we were talking about the debt ceiling issue and talking about it. And then we went into fund tribe mode and then we didn't talk about it. And then it got resolved. Mm-hmm. And thank God, because that meant when we came back, we didn't have to talk about it. Well, now what's happening is this from the New York Times. The debt deal is behind them, but lawmakers are plunging into a bitter spending fight, with House Republicans pushing to pass measures with spending levels below those agreed to in debt limit compromise, infuriating Democrats and raising the prospect of a shutdown this fall. How does that work?
I'm just going to say this. A budget is a budget. A debt ceiling is a ceiling. It doesn't mean that if you agree to this debt ceiling, you therefore must spend up until to the ceiling. And so I think this is sort of like a red herring in a way. Let's just say my borrowing ability is $100 million, which it's not. Let's be clear about that. doesn't mean I have to spend $100 million. In fact, it might not be prudent based on what I think the economy looks like moving forward.
But let's remember that Congress agrees every year on a budget.
Yeah.
So that's the legally binding agreement. So when they say, we're not going to be able to pay everything we agreed to last year because there's this debt ceiling, that's a little disingenuous because Congress has agreed and voted on spending.
Right. And that's how they don't get the blame for it, right?
Yeah. So think about it like this. If your family decides to buy a new car,
right,
you say, are we going to buy a new car? And if the answer is yes, then it's normally implied that, if you do that, then you're going to make the payments every month on that new car. You don't have two separate discussions where you say, are we going to buy a new car? And then you buy a new car. And then a month later, you say, are we going to pay the bills on our new car?
Right.
And that latter scenario is what the debt ceiling effectively does. So the hard right is talking about essentially defunding government agencies. That's going to have a contractionary effect. You're looking at government shutdowns. They're not in favor of lower spending. They're in favor of lower spending for very particular things. They're in favor of huge spending in other areas.
Yeah.
It's just that for things like funding, the Department of Agriculture, which runs the food stamp program, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, they're in favor of slashing those budgets, but are they going to actually slash the Department of Defense budget?
No, probably not.
So let's be clear.
But we're talking about a group of individuals that were annoyed at what happened.
Yeah.
And so they all sat down and decided, let's pull the rug here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get what you're saying, Heather, and agree. But I don't think that's the psychology of what's going on in this.
Yeah, I would not want to be, the therapist for members of Congress.
Oh,
I was like trying to analyze what their motivations are.
Well, I hope
are.
They're seeing therapists.
Yeah.
But
they're
I,
not.
It doesn't seem like they are.
So.
But to me and my little Joe brain, that what's happening here is like the different avenues that they have to obstruct what is going on. So if you say, okay, Kevin McCarthy, if you do this, 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 or this, we're going to pull our support and we're going to send you packing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then they come to some agreement, they stop for a week, they come back and okay. And now we're going to vote less than was proposed.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's could possibly shut everything down.
It has to get through the Senate anyways.
Right.
So I think it's all, this is sort of, like I said, I think it's a red herring. This is people, trying to make a story out of something that I personally don't think is a story. So the Republicans in Congress say, we want to spend less than the debt ceiling. We agreed to this debt ceiling. And that was the magic trick, that got them to agree to the debt ceiling. It still has to get through the Senate.
Sure.
The Senate is controlled by the Democrats.
The it's important to think about the kind of the overarching issue here of just in terms of how this affects investor confidence and the ability of U.S. government bonds to serve their role in supporting a healthy global financial system. All of these actions just slowly chisel away at that.
Yeah.
It makes us look like a banana republic in terms of like, oh, look at this government. Look at these bozos, you know, I don't know,
but
their clown wigs trying to talk about
Defense funding. I'm just
going to
say this, right? We just heard within the last couple weeks, we heard that New York State is looking at a $30 billion deficit in 2 years, something like that. $30 billion is not a small chunk of the state budget. And so the right thing to do under those circumstances, and what the state does is they start slow rolling dollars out the door so that they can get into another fiscal year with a surplus and they can use that. But all those magic tricks aside, the right thing to do would be to slow down your spending, which means—
Or increase taxes.
Or increase taxes, but do mid-year corrections. Now, New York has to have a balanced budget. It's a little different.
Sure,
we can't run a deficit. But the thing is that's it's all the same thing. If you know that there's not going to be enough money, it's not unreasonable to adjust your spending in the interim or your revenue in the interim to try and, you know, offset. I mean, the problem in New York State with the budget is in large part self-inflicted. We took federal one-time money and we used it to spend on programs that are recurring.
Mm-hmm.
Well, duh.
Yeah, right.
You know, so if you sell a car, you can't take that money and use it to, you know, to buy a new car and another new car and expect that you're going to have enough money to do it. You can't, you know, a one-time chunk of money is not income. It is income, but it's temporary.
Mm-hmm.
It's one time. It's not recurring. You can't build structural out your spending on it. And we did that. So we made our own problem. Now we have to solve it. We can go back to the feds, I guess. I'm sure they'll be happy to send
more aid to states.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
We have a Congress.
I mean,
certainly
the other problem with the discussion about federal spending is the discretionary spending is such a minute part of the overall federal budget.
Right.
You know, so what they're arguing about is such a small percentage.
Right. I mean,
it's still huge dollars.
60% of all the U.S. government, and I'm quoting Paul Krugman here, is a insurance company with an army, right? 60% of all federal spending goes to Social Security and Medicare. That's 20% and 20% approximately. And the other 20% goes to national defense.
Yeah.
Right. So you're looking at less than half of all federal spending. Part of that's just to run the government. There is very little to be had in terms of nickel and diming these other programs. So no, that's an excellent point.
Parker writes and says, "Dear panel, good morning. Your show makes me want to move to New Zealand. Thank you, Parker."
Oh.
Sorry, Parker.
We don't
New
have
Zealand's
Tasmanian
beautiful,
doubles.
Though.
Yeah, it's a damn good radio.
Enjoy.
There.
Yeah.
Eileen says, "Is it true that the utility companies are required to add fees to their bills? That money, among other things, funds NYSERDA, New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. NYSERDA, among other things, runs programs to help low-income families make their homes more energy efficient."
True.
All right. Anybody else? Okay, let's go on to another subject then, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we only have about two. Actually, let me go to a couple more letters because we only have about 2 minutes before we have to take a break. So I'll do that. Michael says, "Some housekeeping things perhaps worth considering in today's discussion. How about being specific and providing factual details to support your broad, generalized, vague statements like lots of corporations do this and lots of corporations do that. Putting others on the defensive with generalized vagaries is little more than gaslighting. And please allow others to complete their statements before you jump in and talk over them and cut them off."
I think I know this person. They write to me sometimes on the weekends.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Interestingly, he's moving to New Zealand.
Oh, same guy?
No.
Oh, dear. We're a big hit.
Yeah, big hit. Yes, we have a current and projected future labor shortage. So why do immigrants need to wait for many months before they can get a work permit? Why do we demonize immigration? And thanks, Fox News. Convince our populace that immigration will bring crime and horrifying behavior. There is a simple answer to the labor shortage, which also includes a Social Security disaster in the near future. We need to change that narrative.
I agree. I think that we have to work around this, the work prohibitions for folks who are coming in.
We
need people in the labor force.
It's going to have to change.
And by the way, not everyone who's coming in is entry level unskilled. I mean, there's a ton of people with backgrounds in healthcare and education. And so we should let them work.
I mean, the fact of the matter, my family, they were immigrants. We're all immigrants. It's a ridiculous thing that's happening right now. It's hateful and it needs to stop. It is of a certain segment. It's the people we were just talking about that are throwing their weight around, that have no business throwing their weight around. But who voted for these people? Who?
Well, somebody did.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Maybe
All
they
right.
can improve the education system and stop banning books.
We have one more letter and then we'll take a break. Hi, panel. I'm wondering what you think about a windfall tax on corporations, seeing that the bulk of inflation was caused by profit seeking. Thank you, Forrest.
Yeah, that's
a repeat.
That's a source. Again, it came from shocks like COVID and supply chain bottlenecks, Putin's invasion of Ukraine. There's the demand side of the Trump and Biden COVID relief packages. There's
pandemic shutdowns.
Yeah, there's corporate opportunism. This is an abnormal time. From 1980 up until 2020, inflation was largely under control.
It doesn't feel like an abnormal time.
Really?
Yeah.
There's many sources for inflation. Corporate greed is one of them.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with this great group, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Thank you very much for being with us. It's very nice to have you here. We missed you for those few moments where you were away. Let's go to other topics. We only have about 15, 20 minutes left, so let's see what kind of trouble we can get to in that period of time. So let's go, since we have Kate here, and I'd like to talk about arts education. New York City is having a fine time of it. They had a protest yesterday where students, council members, rallied for more arts programs in New York City schools. It's arguments like this that are happening across the country. Local schools falling woefully short of statewide arts education requirements. New York City students and their allies in the council are making a final push to fund more programs and qualified staff next school year. By the time students graduate middle school, they are supposed to have taken at least two different arts classes taught by certified teachers, but only 34% of city students met that standard last year, in line with pre-pandemic trends, according to the Department of Education in a report released last month. So, the share of kids who take any two arts courses at all, with or without a licensed instructor, has plummeted since schools closed during the pandemic. Just over half of middle school graduates had instruction in dance, music, theater, or visual arts, compared to almost 9 in 10 in previous years. Kate, what do we do?
Well, right before the break, or maybe it was during the break, you were talking, Heather, about talking to your kids and telling them to listen, and to listen to people that have different views.
Right.
And the first thing we talk about to actors when we're training them is that it's not about speaking, it's about listening. And the other thing we say is, what you're going to learn here is you're going to learn what it means to step into someone else's shoes. So as soon as you put on someone else's shoes, you have to understand who that person is. And honestly, those of us that work in the theater, in the not-for-profit world, we operate under constraints financially, sometimes severe, And when we can't find the money, we use our imagination to solve a problem. We open on time and we close. And then we open again on time. And we demand a team work together. I also had a conversation a couple of weeks ago that was amazing to me. A woman that was talking about what she lived through in COVID, and that she said she felt her imagination was starved because she couldn't get to a museum. She couldn't get to the arts. She couldn't watch movies even. I mean, what happened during that time period? When we finally opened up again to the kids that we work with, and we work with 10,000 school kids in Berkshire County, one of the most remarkable discussions was with this young man named Alex, who came up to me and said, I live in one of the hill towns. My life was like falling apart, and this brought my life back to me. I mean, for kids to be able to be with kids, it's the same as team sports. It's a team sport. But the arts are essential to who we are. They teach us how to speak. They teach us how to sing, how to see the world in different ways. Last night I was at one of our plays, which I'll talk about later, but it was called Photograph 51. I learned about science. I learned about history. I learned about how people think. I learned about how wars are created, how battles are made in an hour and a half. That's a pretty good lesson. So what we offer is incredible. But the arts have always been under the gun. I mean, the banning of books, which I yelled about a little earlier, having people read, having kids be able to read, they can't write if they can't read. I mean, one thing follows the other. The arts are essential to who we are. They're part of, you know, breathing life. But we've gone through these periods before. What I thought, one of the lines that I found interesting, was that Mayor Adams said, and I wrote this down, that more field trips and partnerships with cultural institutions. Bring them in. But I hope you fund us.
And I hope you can afford the gas for the buses to send them to the...
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Syracuse, and my father was the art teacher at my high school, and also taught an arts class at Le Moyne College, you know, silk screening and printmaking.
Oh,
and,
lovely.
And, you know, I have a great appreciation for the arts, but it's also a hugely important part of getting kids enthusiastic about going to school. You know, some kids want to go because they want to be part of the football team. Some kids want to go because they love the drama class or the music or whatever else it is that
being creative
is. Yeah, that is not sit down and learn math, which, by the way, you can learn math through music, you know.
Absolutely.
And musicians often make really good computer programmers, which I know from one of my members. She says she loves...
Or economists.
Or economists.
It's creative thinking, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think it's really important. It's really a shame. And given the amount of money in our public education system in New York, and we spend more than every other state, and we spend more than the next highest state by a third, and our outcomes are middle of the pack at best. There is something wrong.
It seems to me that the arts are so important to our economy, as we were talking about earlier.
Agree, yeah.
The arts are so important to our communities, the artistic institutions that we have. So what better place to integrate within the community between the students and the arts organizations? And it doesn't seem like that would be that hard to do. The arts organizations would love to have them. The kids would love to be there. And yet there's still that.
There's always been that.
That block.
I mean, the thing is that the arts have been around for a long time. The theater goes back to the Greeks. So I don't worry that they're ever going to go away, but it's always been a struggle. And part of the struggle is that in the artist's mind, they're creating a truth, whether it's in a painting or in a dance. And some people don't want to hear certain truths, but that's where the listening
comes. Yeah, I was going to say arts has, you know, has always been, artists have, you know, been critical of power structures.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you look at, you know, public funding of that, that's, you know, I don't want to say it could pose a threat to the existing social order if you actually fund the arts and get kids to think creatively, and the powers that be, you know, don't necessarily, they're not interested in that.
This some is of very us true. Some of that's us a are. Dangerous kind of society.
Yeah, no. Right. And that's the same. Don't read that book.
Exactly.
You
don't
may
read
do
the
this.
Books. What is that? It's unbelievable banning books. I don't want anybody to tell me which books my children can read or can't read. For God's sake. And if you look at the books that they're selecting, ban the state.
Well, New York isn't banning books, I don't think.
No,
right?
They're not. But well, certainly there are several states right now that are engaged.
Oh, yeah.
New York. No. We like New York.
And I believe, you say that, Heather, but there are libraries in New York State in very red areas that are trying to, library boards that are trying to ban certain books.
I don't even get that. I mean, if a library is supposed to be a place where you have access to what there is, are you just like denying that book exists by not having it?
I think you want to deny that it exists.
I mean, people can get them online.
I'm holding my cell phone in my hand. Any book you want, you can get on this device. Any book that a kid wants to read, they can get on this device. By the way, you can also get porn, I hear. So, like...
I'm shocked.
Like, so, mm-hmm. I mean...
Tool tickets.
Yeah.
Exactly. My point being, you have movies, everything. It's all here, and yet we're going to deny To Kill a Mockingbird to be in a school library. It just doesn't make any sense.
No, I think we're all in agreement on this
one. All right.
But it's a way to flash power. It's a way to flash the ideology of the ruling class of, like, this is what we deem to be appropriate. And that carries cultural value, even though there are plenty of ways to get around it and read the book. But it's a way for politicians to, you know, like DeSantis in Florida, just like, you know, flex his muscle as he has a temper tantrum about the new thing bothering him.
Wait until we get a super artsy person in power and they're like, we're going to ban the books that are bad and bad art. You know,
yeah.
Like,
not the critic. No, that would be a critic,
right.
Not an artist.
Yeah.
By the way, apropos of what we're talking about, I just would, if you haven't seen it yet, there's an amazing article that was published toward the end of May in the Washington Post and was just republished last week. But it is about book banning in schools. And through the investigation of the Washington Post that did a really deep dive into these requests to ban books, found out that it's 11 people.
It's a really tiny number.
It's 11 people who across the country are filing the request to ban the books. So when you think of that, of the power of what is happening, and then obviously a lot of people, you know, jump onto that bandwagon, but 11 people.
Oh, that's ridiculous. They should go form their own country.
Yes, somewhere else, far away.
I hear New Zealand is... All right. We are just about out of time, but I do want to talk about the Donald Trump and his boxes. Sometimes it's just too much fun. So this story is from the New York Times, and it is talking about at the heart of the documents case is Trump's attachment to his boxes. The former president has long stowed papers and odds and ends and cartons that he liked to keep close. His aides have called it the beautiful mind material. It was a reference to the title of a book and movie depicting the life of John Nash, the mathematician with schizophrenia, played in a film by Russell Crowe, who covered his office with newspaper clippings, believing they held a Russian code he needed to crack. The phrase had a specific connotation. The aides employed it to capture a type of organized chaos that Mr. Trump insisted on, the collection and transportation of a blizzard of newspapers and official documents that he kept close and that seemed to give him a sense of security. One former White House official who was granted anonymity to describe the situation said that while the materials were disorganized, Mr. Trump would notice if someone had rifled through them or they were not arranged in a particular way. It was, the person said, you know, how his mind worked. The contents of those boxes and Mr. Trump's insistence on hanging on to them are now at the heart of a 38-count indictment against the former president and his personal aide.
Wow. First of all, as an economist, I resent the fact that somebody is comparing Donald Trump's brain to the functioning of a Nobel Prize-winning economist who created an entire branch of economics called game theory. So, no.
But they could say that in front of him because he wouldn't know the story behind.
No, of course, right?
So
he just
they thought
beautiful
he,
mind. And,
yes,
yeah.
He thought, I have a
beautiful mind.
My favorite
too.
Thing is when you look at that picture of the bathroom with all of the things stocked, it's like there's still, and this is how we know he's a germaphobe, you can still see a little bottle of soap next to the sink. And I always thought that was just like so comic.
I'm just going to say I went through a period of time in my 20s when I moved a lot. And I had some boxes.
Really?
And one time I opened a box and it had like mail in it from the place I lived 3 years before.
Bills.
Oh yeah. Like I just because I would I'm like I'm I have to move. I'm a procrastinator. I'm late for everything, which I always demonstrate. But and so I would throw things in a box and move. And that's what I kind of assumed that this was initially, that, you know, okay, I can understand that. He threw stuff that was on his desk in a box and then he moved. I'm going to go through it later. Like in my case, 3 years later. But that's not what this is.
No, this seems to be a fondness to have this. It's his binky.
I mean, yes. We're sitting up here laughing, but it's not. There's a whole other side of this that we all wish would end.
Unfortunately, we have to end. My apologies. Heather, thank you very much for being here. Aaron, have a beautiful weekend. Kate, stand by. We'll talk to you in just a few minutes about what's happening at Berkshire Theater Group. We'll be back right after this.